Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We have one case to be submitted to this panel on oral argument today, United States versus Skilling, and we'll hear first from Mr. Petrocelli.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. We are here on remand because the Supreme Court invalidated the broad fiduciary theory of honest services fraud pursued in this case. And because this error permeated the government's case against Mr. Skilling, we submit it was deeply harmful and that all the convictions below must be reversed. Now, the government's position is that the error was harmless because the entire case against Mr. Skilling was about securities fraud. They now say that honest services fraud was inconsequential. And I submit that the government's actions and the record below speak much louder than their words now. The government fought tooth and nail to pursue honest services fraud against Mr. Skilling, and we tried everything possible to keep it out of the case, including moving to dismiss it from the indictment. The government was able to overcome that motion. And when it came time to instructing the jury, the government insisted on the honest services instruction against Mr. Skilling over our objection, telling Judge Lake, quote, "The government's evidence shows that the defendants committed or conspired to commit honest services fraud by breaching their fiduciary duties to Enron and its shareholders." The jury instructions told the jury no fewer than six times in the conspiracy instructions that the jury could convict Mr. Skilling of conspiracy on the basis of either securities fraud or wire fraud containing the honest services theory. The jury was specifically told that the government was accusing Mr. Skilling of conspiring in two different ways, and that one way was enough. And throughout the trial, the government sought to establish that Skilling breached his fiduciary duties by creating a culture and taking actions that were not in Enron's best interests, especially as Mr. Skilling was vigorously contesting the securities fraud allegations every step of the way. Now, for every area of Enron's business that the government challenged that trial, the jury was able to evaluate and decide on guilt based on honest services without having to find securities fraud. So, for example, in the earnings management part of the case, the government said that there were adjustments made at the end of quarters that falsified the numbers.
Mr. Petrocelli, let me ask you this. It was remanded back to us from the Supreme Court, and I think the bulk of what we have to do is evaluate the evidence that was presented on the trial court level. Could we refer this further down to the trial court to evaluate if there was sufficient evidence to uphold these convictions? I mean, is the trial court in a better position to review the record and determine? I mean, the trial court was there, heard everything. We did not. We're going to have to read a lot of material. But is it easier or more practical for the trial court to be making this decision? Or are we somehow restricted by the remand from the Supreme Court to make this decision?
Your Honor, I do not know of any rule that requires this court to review the record and decide this issue. However, both sides have submitted the issues. Both sides have fully briefed it. Neither side has requested that it be sent down to the district court to conduct this review. It is a question of law whether or not the harmless error standard beyond a reasonable doubt has been met here. There's no deference to any rulings of the district court that are in play here. It's simply a legal question whether the government can meet its burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt, as they say on page 2 of their brief, and we don't disagree, no rational jury could have failed to find Skilling guilty of conspiring to commit securities fraud. And that's a legal test that has to be determined, as the court knows, by reviewing the entire record. Not only the government's evidence, but all the defense evidence, all the cross-examination evidence, all of our documents, and the court and the government is not entitled to a presumption that the evidence be viewed in the light most favorable to it. And the cases make clear, going back to Nader, that if the record contains evidence that could rationally lead to acquittal on the conspiracy to commit securities fraud, starting with count one, then the conviction must be reversed. The court doesn't act as a 13th juror. The court doesn't decide for itself whether the court thinks that the defendant was guilty. The court looks at the record, and if the record contains evidence by which a rational jury could have acquitted on the valid theory of guilt, and in the conspiracy count, that would be conspiracy to commit securities fraud, according to the government, then there has to be a reversal. And here, the record is filled with acquittal evidence.
If we should decide, and I'm not suggesting we will or we won't, but if we should decide that the error as to count one was harmless, where are you on the other counts?
Was harmless? We have no argument on the other counts. We have to show, the government has to show that the error on count one was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. If they're able to carry that burden, we don't think they conceivably can on this record, then that would be we wouldn't have any further arguments because it requires a reversal of the conspiracy count in order to then show how that conviction affected each of the other counts. The Pinkerton counts directly through the jury instructions, which directly incorporated the conspiracy count and the conspiracy allegations, and then into the remaining six counts. Now, the analysis on the remaining six counts is the same, but we have to do a little bit more work on those last six counts, the false statement to auditors and the insider trading count, because unlike the first 13 counts, the conspiracy count and the 12 securities fraud counts, where you have instructional error directly embedded in the instructions, on the last six, we have to look to the overall record and the argument that the government was making and the evidence as it was presented to see how a rational jury might have concluded that it affected those counts. And so on the conspiracy count, we have seen no case, and government has not cited a case, where there was a wealth of such evidence where the defendant contested the valid theory of guilt and where the court found harmless error. The government's own witnesses testified that Skilling did not lie on certain calls, that Skilling was not involved in the preparation of these public filings that led to a number of counts, that Skilling didn't make the side deals except in just two instances, and those were heavily disputed. They alleged that other witnesses made the side deals or other people at Enron.
You know, as to the insider trading, those were undeniably his actions. Isn't that right?
His actions in trading on the stock, but as the government pointed out in arguing that the insider trading counts, the jury could look to the conspiracy as the non-public inside information on which Skilling traded. And as you know, the jury acquitted Mr. Skilling of all the trades during the time he was at Enron. This was the one trade after he left Enron, and based on the evidence that was presented, a rational jury could easily have concluded that Skilling traded this one and only time based on his knowledge that his participation in a conspiracy was about to be disclosed to the public. And it's for that reason that we think that count has to be reversed because it's directly connected to the conspiracy count. Once the jury concludes that Skilling participated in a conspiracy, and since we can't rule out on the government's test that was a conspiracy to commit securities fraud, we have this infirm conspiracy theory that is now spread through the entire case.
You said rule out, but rule out is not the standard that we're looking at.
It is not the standard, and I probably spoke too quickly. The standard is whether or not, and it's right out of Nader, there's any evidence in the record from which that could lead a rational jury to acquit Skilling on the conspiracy to commit securities fraud. And as I was saying, the charge of securities fraud against Skilling was contested every step of the way. So there's mountains of such evidence, including from the mouths of the government's own witnesses. And the government doesn't really deal with any of this evidence in their brief. They simply highlight their evidence, but this is not a sufficiency review. The court is required to examine the entire record. And we, in our papers, pointed to the evidence on pages 25 to 38 of our opening brief on appeal, pages 1 to 14 of our reply brief, on these remand papers, in our opening brief, pages 23 to 36, and in our reply at pages 9 to 20, we set forth all of the evidence contesting securities fraud against Jeff Skilling, and including, for example, what happened with the government's lead securities fraud witness on Mr. Skilling, the head of investor relations named Mark Koenig, the very first witness to testify. And at one of the critical events in the case, where Enron gathered all the analysts from all over the country to come here in Houston on January 25, 2001, to hear Mr. Skilling and Mr. Lay and other executives talk about the business, we showed the jury a videotape of all of Mr. Skilling's remarks with Mr. Koenig on the stand. And I gave him a piece of paper and I said, now I want you to write down everything untrue that Mr. Skilling said. And after all, this was the government's main securities fraud witness. And that page was blank. He could not identify a single thing that Mr. Skilling said that was untrue, although he identified one thing that Mr. Lay said that he thought was untrue. And in each of the securities fraud counts on which Mr. Skilling was convicted, as the court knows, there was a direct Pinkerton instruction that allowed the jury to convict Mr. Skilling on the basis of the acts of others. And we've gone through each of those counts in our papers. And for every one of those counts, starting with count two, count 14, 16 to 20, and 22 to 26, we have identified substantial acts of other conspirators relating to the conduct at issue in those counts by which a jury readily could have relied on convicting Mr. Skilling. Most of the conspirators admitted to committing securities fraud, and a number of them testified or pled guilty to committing securities fraud. Ben Glisson, Andy Fastow, they were the principal architects of the LJM structures that dominated count 14 and 16 through 20. Once the jury concluded there was a conspiracy, and once other witnesses were testifying that they committed securities fraud in connection with those counts, the jury easily could have relied on those other actions. Same thing is true with the calls that they put into evidence where Mr. Skilling spoke to the analysts. There were five such times. Count 22 is the January 22 call. Well, Mark Koenig pled guilty to lying on that call. The January 25 analyst conference, that's count 23, Ken Rice and Kevin Hannon pled guilty to lying at that conference. On count 24, Koenig made statements about EBS, and he had testified that his statements about EBS and EES were false. And he testified that he did not think Skilling, quote, was trying to fool the analysts about the state of EBS's business. That's the March 23 call. On the April 17 call, that's count 25, Koenig pled guilty to lying on that call. And on the final call, the July 12 call, count 26, Koenig's guilty plea also indicates that he made false statements. And so for every one of these 12 counts, you have two things going on. Number one, you have Mr. Skilling vigorously presenting evidence contesting the securities fraud allegations. And a rational jury could easily have relied on that evidence to find that he did not directly commit securities fraud. At the same time, for each of those counts, you have other co-conspirators admitting to doing securities fraud in those counts. And so you had based on the presentation of the case, based on the reliance of the conspiracy, the jury readily could have concluded in fact, that Skilling was being held vicariously responsible for the acts of others. In fact, during closing argument, the government linked count one through a series of slides, and I'm just holding one up by way of example. The series of slides, this one has to do with count one, the conspiracy count, linking directly to counts 14, 16, and 18. And so they held up these graphics in their closing arguments to the jurors, showing how the conspiracy count linked to the 12 securities fraud counts, so the jury could understand that they could convict Skilling based on the acts of others. And the prosecutor made that argument to the jury, arguing and actually reading out the Pinkerton instruction to the jury.
Wasn't there, though, besides the conspiracy and others involved, wasn't there some evidence of his direct involvement where the jury might have found him directly involved?
Yeah, well, we don't agree with the evidence, and we're not making a sufficiency a challenge here, but yes, we're not saying the government did not present evidence and argument of securities fraud by Mr. Skilling, or that they didn't present evidence and argument about conspiracy to commit securities fraud, but that's not the test. Because they injected an invalid theory of guilt into the case, they have a heavy burden now. They had to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury could not have convicted him based on this invalid theory. And we have a general verdict. You know, we wanted a special one. They asked for a general one. We got a general one. And so we don't know how the jury ruled.
Aren't you injecting that impossible to tell standard all over again?
Not at all. Our reply brief makes clear that we fully acknowledge the test that the government formulates on page 2 of its reply brief, whether no rational jury could have failed to find Skilling guilty under a valid theory. And we explained in a footnote.
But then you follow up by saying you can't tell. There is no way to tell.
Well, that's the reason why we have to conduct the harmless error analysis. And what the courts are saying, starting with Nader, as Hedgepeth and now the Skilling case make clear, that's the test to be applied here. Both sides agree on that. That's the one thing that nobody disagrees about. The test now, because we can't tell, the test is whether there's evidence in the record that could rationally lead to acquittal on the valid theory of guilt. Because if there is, the other theory we know is invalid, and therefore we lack the requisite assurance that the jury might not have relied on the invalid theory.
So I'm a little bit confused about your analysis of the law here, because you've acknowledged that the impossible to tell is not the standard, and yet you're telling us that that Howard survives Hedgepeth.
Well,
Hedgepeth.
Yes, and the reason why we say that, although it's not, we don't have to follow Howard in order to reach the result here. But in Howard, the court did not follow a rule of automatic reversal. The court did review the record and did find that in that case there was acts of other conspirators on which Howard might have been held liable.
Your statement, I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought because you're answering my question, but your statement from your reply brief is pretty strong. You say Howard controls and compels reversal of the 12 Pinkerton-linked securities fraud convictions. You seem to be relying pretty heavily on Howard.
Well, because the court happened to have had an occasion to deal with the issue in virtually the identical circumstance, in fact involving part of the same conspiracy. The point of Howard is that once you had a flawed conspiracy conviction, which was accepted for the purpose of Howard because the government did not oppose that, and so it came up to this court with a conspiracy convict count that the government conceded was flawed. And the question was whether it affected the substantive books and records count. And the analysis that the court went through in that opinion is that it looked at the record. It conducted a review of the record to see if a rational jury could have relied on the flawed conspiracy count and found Howard responsible because of his participation in the conspiracy count. And in order to see if there was any record evidence that could have led to that conclusion, the court saw that Connie Lee, for example, had testified, that she was a participant. Michael Krautz was a participant. This had to do with Project Braveheart, of course. And so based on that, the court said that a jury could have reasonably relied. That's the same test that we are urging here. It's the same thing that was just happened on Friday in the Black case, and we submitted a brief letter on that this morning. If the record contained...
And we did get your letter. So.
Yes, and we had responded because the government had notified the court of the of the ruling. And that case fully supports the same analysis that both sides are urging here, and it comes right out of the government's brief. It's on page 2. They say no rational jury could have failed to find that Skilling conspired to commit securities fraud. So if a rational jury could have failed to find that Skilling conspired to commit securities fraud, there needs to be a reversal. The government would agree with that. Their argument is not with the standard. Their argument is that there's only one conclusion that this record permits the court to make, and that is that the jury could only have found Skilling guilty of conspiracy to commit securities fraud. And in making that argument, they fail completely to deal with the evidence of the defense contesting the securities fraud.
What about the Sullivan subjective test? I mean, you seem to have relied on that somewhat, but the government claims that that's no longer the valid test after Nader. Are you still relying on that?
Not at all.
Well, I mean, in your brief, you pointed to what this jury must have done rather than to what a theoretical rational
Your
jury
Honor,
would do.
If there's confusion in our brief, I apologize for that. It's not what the jury actually did, since we don't know because of the general verdict. What we have to do is we have to look to the record to see what a rational or reasonable jury would have done with this evidence. And so it's not a subjective test about what the actual jury did, because we don't know. And so we have to go through this exercise of trying to determine. And I've indicated that both sides agree on that test. And I think that the government has failed completely to make the showing, because they don't even address the evidence, Your Honor. If you go look at pages 15 to 27 of their opposition brief on the remand here, they only discuss their evidence but not the contrary evidence. And the Supreme Court in Nader said, quote, "A reviewing court makes this harmless error inquiry, in making this harmless error inquiry, a reviewing court does not become in effect a second jury to determine whether the defendant is guilty. Rather, a court in typical appellate court fashion asks whether the record contains evidence that could rationally lead to a contrary finding." And that's what we're saying exactly here. If the record contains evidence that could lead to a finding, rationally interpreted, a logical basis in the evidence for a finding that Skilling did not conspire to commit securities fraud, under the government's own articulation of the test, the conspiracy count has to be reversed. And then when you have a reverse conspiracy count, once you go through the Pinkerton the 12 security fraud counts, because we have shown the evidence contesting Mr. Skilling's direct participation for securities fraud and the presence of substantial evidence that others committed securities fraud, the only conclusion that can be drawn, we submit, is that a rational jury could have acquitted Mr. Skilling for his direct participation. And then on the false statements to auditors, the government put up the slide that said that there was no fraud at Enron, and the jury, having convicted Mr. Skilling of an honest services fraud, could readily have relied on that. And there was no definition of fraud in the false statement to auditor counts, but there was a definition of fraud in the conspiracy section.
Can we have a situation where the jury could have, but there was overwhelming evidence? What if we have overwhelming evidence? I mean, the jury could
right.
do anything they want to, and just because you say the jury could have, But that's not quite the standard that we're looking at.
I think both sides agree on the standard. If the evidence was so overwhelmingly one-sided that it could permit of only one conclusion, no rational jury could have failed to find a Skilling guilty of whatever the valid theory is, then harmless error would have been demonstrated. But if there is any evidence by which a rational jury might have acquitted Mr. Skilling on the valid theory, just has to be a rational basis in the evidence. We're not weighing the evidence. We're looking in the evidence, in the record. And that's why we went to great pains to lay this out. We're looking in the record for whether there is evidence in the record that could rationally lead to acquittal. I see that I'm out of time.
Yes, your initial time's expired, and you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Charlie, thank you. Mr. Wilson?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Douglas Wilson on behalf of the United States. The inclusion of the honest services fraud as one of three objects of the conspiracy alleged in count one was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for two reasons. And the first reason, I think, is a reason that the defendant has not touched on today, and that is drawn from this court's decisions in Sachs and Holly. And those cases stand for the proposition that when the government essentially alleges and proves a single conspiracy, that is, a single conspiracy that partakes of both the valid and the invalid theory, then the error is harmless if the valid theory was the, quote, overwhelming and predominant theory. That standard is drawn from this court's decision in Sachs. And it's basically the same standard that was applied on Friday in the Seventh Circuit's decision in Black. So the submission that we're making is that the first ground on which the court can find the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is that there was simply a single conspiracy involving both securities fraud and, incidentally, honest services fraud.
Do you think the trial judge in Sachs messed up?
No, Your Honor. Did the trial judge in Sachs?
Yes.
Well, no, Your Honor. Sachs was tried before McNally, and therefore the court was relying on
I'm just testing you because I was the trial judge on Sachs.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your Honor followed existing law. I didn't look that closely at the case.
It seems to me you're stretching it if you use the word incidental to describe the honest services charge.
Well, Your Honor.
If as Mr. Petricelli pointed out, and it's in the briefs as well, the number of times that the government reminded the jury that it could convict on either theory. And it's easier to convict on honest services probably than securities. So.
I think we disagree with that point, Your Honor, that it's easier in this case. But I don't think I'm overstating it to say that the evidence is incidental. And I'd point the court to two things in particular within the record that I think show that. The first is the indictment itself, which if you read the indictment, the word honest services appears only in the conspiracy count and in the counts that charge wire fraud. By contrast, the entire rest of the indictment charges basically a scheme to deprive Enron's investors and the investing public of information they needed to know in order to buy, sell, or hold Enron securities. And that is a securities fraud conspiracy. If the court, and I can point the court to four paragraphs in the indictment that I think typify this. The first is paragraph 5, which sets forth the scheme that the government alleged the defendants conspired to commit. And that has two objects, both of which are securities fraud objects. Paragraph 10 sets forth the roles of the defendants, and it states that Skilling's role was to provide false information to investors. Paragraph 19 of the indictment sets forth the objectives of the scheme, and virtually all of those involve false statements to investors or manipulating Enron's share price in order to deceive the investing public. And paragraph 28 sets forth the devices that the defendants used to perpetrate their scheme, and virtually all of those involve manipulation of information or deceiving the investing public.
Let me ask you the question that I ask of them is the trial court in a better position to evaluate the evidence that was presented and make this decision? And could we or should we remand this even further to the trial court to evaluate?
Your Honor, I think you certainly could be remanded to the trial court, and the trial court sat through a 5-month trial and is and was deeply and aware of the evidence. So I think the trial court probably is in a better position at this point to review the evidence. As to whether the court should do that, I think that's really a question of now or later, frankly, because if the trial court reviews if you remand to the trial court and it reviews the evidence, the case will come back to you and the review will have to occur, your review will have to occur at that point in any event. So I don't think this court can avoid having to do the kind of review mandated by the harmless error standard by remanding to the district court. It's just a question of letting the district court take the first crack at that.
I mean, normally harmless error would be for the Court of Appeals. I can't remember sending harmless error back to a district court.
That's correct. And as I say, Your Honor, I don't think that there's any, as Mr. Petrocelli agreed, I don't think there's any rule that says the court can't do it. But I think given the state of the record, the court would only be putting off what it's going to have to do anyway, which is review the record to determine whether the error is harmless. The second thing I wanted
to point... Back to the honest services question that I asked you before, and I'm just going to read you a passage from Mr. Skilling's brief and let you respond to it. But on that question, this is several lines long, but here's what they say in their brief. Indeed, in successfully arguing for a capacious honest services instruction, the government equated honest service fraud with a mere breach of any fiduciary duty, not the limited securities fraud theory it now posits. And then they quote from the record, government counsel arguing, and saying, the government's evidence shows that defendants committed or conspired to commit honest services fraud by breaching their fiduciary duties to Enron and its shareholders. I'm asking you that in the context of your statement that this was just incidental.
Well, I can't deny, Your Honor, that it's in the indictment and that the jury was instructed on it. I think that, however, is just the starting point for this court's analysis of whether it's harmless. And I think if you look at the record as a whole, including the indictment, the evidence, and the closing argument, it played a minor incidental role in the trial. And I think the best evidence of that is the closing arguments. If the court does nothing else, if it looks through the closing arguments, it'll see that honest services played almost no role in either side's closing argument. For example, in the government's opening summation, honest services is mentioned exactly once. By contrast, investors, investing, investments, or other references to investing are mentioned 112 times. So it's clear that the government prosecutor believed that this was a case about lying to investors and deceiving the investing public, and not a case about honest services. By the same token, Mr. Skilling's closing argument didn't mention honest services at all. And I think it's reasonable to conclude that if this was a case about honest services, Mr. Skilling would feel compelled to defend against it. But his closing argument does not mention honest services at all. And finally, our rebuttal closing, the government's rebuttal closing, mentions honest services 11 times, but 10 of those involve Skilling's co-defendant, Lay. And I think it's worth noting there that Lay was charged with two substantive counts of honest services violation. So what we think the trial record shows is that the case against Skilling was a securities fraud case. Every transaction, every misrepresentation he made to the public, everything that the government proved at trial was meant to show that he deceived the investing public or that he manipulated Enron's earnings in order to prop up its share price. Honest services was certainly part of the case, but as the Seventh Circuit recently pointed out in Black on Friday, the fact that the government proved dishonesty and therefore might have proved a violation of honest services doesn't mean that the scheme as a whole was not a scheme to deprive the public a scheme to commit securities fraud. I want to hit briefly on the defendant's point that the government is not looking at the evidence the government's not looking at the entire record, and that the evidence is not viewed in the light most favorable to the government. The issue before this court is not whether Skilling is guilty or not. This is the standard of review, the harmless error standard, is not an opportunity for Skilling to re-argue whether he's guilty or not of these charges. The question is, what basis did the jury find fraud on? And so I think that to the extent that Skilling is arguing There's evidence that that these were not misrepresentations, or there's evidence that these transactions were not fraudulent. That evidence is not relevant to the question whether, in fact, the error is harmless, because the question is, did the jury find an honest services fraud, or did the jury find a conspiracy to commit securities fraud? In either case, the jury found fraud, and the question is, what does the evidence show about that? And that's why I think the government's brief focuses on the evidence of guilt, because it tends to show that the evidence of guilt overwhelmingly went to a conspiracy to commit securities fraud. Stilling's substantive response to the government's argument that we simply proved a single conspiracy in which securities fraud was the predominant, overwhelmingly predominant object, and honest services was incidental, is really to focus on a couple of transactions. And the two transactions I think he focuses on most closely are the LJM transactions and the use of wholesale. In LJM, as the court is aware, Enron's chief financial officer set up a company called LJM, and then it then engaged in a series of transactions that were designed to conceal losses or inflate Enron's earnings and thereby deceive the investing public. Skilling suggests that it was the creation of that entity, LJM, was a violation of honest services, and therefore that the jury could have found the defendant guilty based on a violation of honest services. But that was never the government's argument at trial. Andy Fastow, who set up LJM, testified that the sole reason to set it up was to make Enron's numbers look better. That's what the indictment alleges in paragraph 32. And the government's closing argument repeatedly argues that the purpose of LJM was to make Enron's earnings look better, make its numbers look better, and thereby deceive the investing public. Pretty much the same thing can be said of the government's evidence about wholesale. Wholesale was an immensely profitable part of Enron. The government showed both that Skilling and his co-conspirators deceived the investing public by portraying wholesale as a, quote, logistics company instead of a trading company, and that they manipulated reserves within wholesale in order to cover losses in other business units. In both cases, the point is to prevent an adverse effect on Enron's share price. In other words, the fraudulent actions within wholesale were actions aimed at committing securities fraud. And in fact, as this court pointed out in its opinion, Skilling told one of his co-conspirators that if the public perceived wholesale as a trading company, the stock would get whacked. And that really encapsulates the government's theory. The evidence about wholesale was evidence about securities fraud. The government's also arguing that the evidence is overwhelming, and I think in that respect, we disagree with Skilling's submission. The standard, as Mr. Petrocelli pointed out, is that the evidence must be so overwhelming that a rational jury could have only come to one conclusion. Again, that's the standard that the Seventh Circuit applied in Black on Friday, and we think it's met here.
What effect does our ruling on the conspiracy count have on the other counts? If we say it's not a valid conviction and throw out the conspiracy, how does it affect the other counts, and vice versa? If we say it is a valid conviction, how does it affect the remaining counts?
If the court finds that the inclusion of harmless error in the conspiracy was harmless error, then I think, as Mr. Petrocelli conceded, there will be no effect on the remaining counts. So if there's no error in the conspiracy count, I think the case is this. That's the end of the court's decision. If the court finds error in the conspiracy count, then the first question is, does that error infect the securities fraud counts? And that requires a determination whether the jury actually relied on the Pinkerton theory to convict Skilling on the substantive securities fraud counts. As the district court found in 2006, we don't think that's the case, that the district court found that the government did not rely on a Pinkerton theory, and we believe that to be the case. And I can go through the the substantive securities fraud counts and explain why that's true. But basically, it boils down to the conclusion that the government's allegations, its evidence, and its argument was that Skilling committed these crimes himself. He did not rely on co-conspirators. He should not be held guilty on those substantive counts because of his co-conspirators' actions. He is responsible for those substantive counts because he committed the actions. That's what the district court found in 2006. Tellingly, the government never argued that the jury should rely on the Pinkerton theory to find Skilling guilty on those substantive counts. In rebuttal closing, the prosecutor mentioned Pinkerton, but then he asked the jury to find Skilling guilty based on transactions that were part of count one. They were not part of any of the substantive counts. So that was a misuse of Pinkerton by the prosecutor, but it obviously doesn't show that the prosecutor relied on Pinkerton to ask the jury to find Skilling guilty on the substantive counts. The substantive securities fraud counts were count two, which was the Raptors count. The government's argument in our submission to this court is that Skilling is personally responsible on that count because he approved of the formation of the Raptors. He approved of its being given to the board of directors, knowing that it contained basically a fraudulent kernel. That is, that LJM got its money back before any assets were hedged into it. And knowing that LJM was not going to lose any money on that, and that aspect of the Raptors deal was concealed from the auditors and the public, Skilling approved it. And that is where his substantive liability comes on that count.
Can this work backwards? I mean, we're looking at the conspiracy and seeing how it affects the other counts. But if you're arguing that there's enough evidence to find him guilty of some of these other counts, does that naturally lead to the possibility that then he's guilty of conspiracy because
yes,
there are some actual actions that he took in these other counts that would
yes.
lead to a conspiracy?
Yes, Your Honor. I was headed in that direction, actually. I think the jury's finding that Skilling committed the substantive securities fraud counts is evidence that the jury found that he was involved or committed a conspiracy to commit securities fraud. There's a certain amount of deciding where the cart is and where the horse is here, but if as the district court found, the jury did not rely on Pinkerton to convict Skilling on the substantive counts, and we think the evidence supports that finding, then the jury's finding that Skilling committed the substantive counts tends to show that he conspired to commit securities fraud. In other words, the jury would not have found him guilty of the substantive securities fraud counts unless it had found that he conspired to commit securities fraud. Briefly on the remainder of the securities fraud counts, the letters to the SEC, or I'm sorry, the SEC filings by Enron, Skilling signed those. It was his signature, knowing of the fraudulent actions that were concealed by those letters. That was the basis for his liability on those counts. The false, there were counts 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26, rests on Skilling's false statements to the investing public during analyst calls, or in one case, an analyst conference. It's true that on some of those counts, other defendants did plead guilty to securities fraud. But the government's argument to the jury and the thrust of the government's proof at trial was that Skilling made misrepresentations during those calls. All of the focus was on Skilling's own statements. And those are the ones that are alleged in the indictment, Skilling statements, with one exception. And those were the basis that the government urged the jury to find him guilty on those.
And what were some of those statements? I don't mean you have to give us all of them, but what were the main ones in which the government?
There were multiple statements for each count, Your Honors. So, for example, count 22, which is the January 22nd, 2001 analyst conference, the indictment alleged and the evidence showed that Skilling said falsely that, quote, the situation in California has had little impact on Enron's fourth quarter results, which was not true because of some substantial liabilities that had occurred in California. He said that nothing could happen in California that would jeopardize Enron's 2001 earnings. He said that the California business was a small portion of Enron's business, all of which the indictment alleged were untrue and all of which the evidence showed were false. Count 23 was the January 25th, 2001 analyst conference, which was focused primarily on EBS. The indictment alleged that Skilling said that EES and EBS were, quote, strong franchises. He said that EBS's network was in place, and he argued that Enron's stock should be valued at $126 per share, and he said that wholesale was not a trading business. Again, the evidence showed, and this is set forth in our Court of Appeals brief, that those statements were false. It's true that Kevin Ken Rice and Kevin Hannon pleaded guilty to securities fraud based on their statements at that conference, but that was never the basis for the government's submission at trial. It was not argued that the jury should find Skilling guilty based on a Pinkerton theory based on their statements, and instead the government asked the jury to focus on Skilling's false statements at trial. Count 24, which is the March 23rd, 2001 analyst call, that call was convened solely because of a drop in Enron's stock price. During that call, Skilling said that Enron was highly confident of its income targets, that it was seeing a positive effect of the chaos in the California markets, that EBS was, quote, coming along just fine, and that he was very comfortable with EBS's volumes and benchmarks, that EBS's profit and loss centers were growing fast, and that they were moving people around within EBS and not moving people out of EBS. The evidence showed that each of those statements were false, and I'm not aware of any evidence that anyone else made false statements during that call that were charged or that could form the basis for a Pinkerton finding by the jury. And I think that count in count 26, which is the July 17th, 2001 analyst call, are based, it's simply indisputable that those counts rested solely on Skilling's statements and not on the statements of anyone else. Count 25 was the April 17th, 2001 analyst call. During that call, Skilling failed to talk about EES's losses, which at that point were quite substantial. He explained the transfer of EES to wholesale as trying to take advantage of wholesale's capacity to manage risk. He repeated that EBS's network was substantially complete, and he omitted a statement about the losses that would be suffered by EBS during this I can't remember if it was this year or this quarter. Again, the evidence at trial showed that each of those was false, and that's how the government argued it. And finally, count 26 is the July 17, 2001 conference. During that call, Skilling said that Enron had a great quarter and that Enron was firmly on track to achieve its second quarter results. The government's evidence again showed that those were false. And again, there was, as far as I'm aware, no evidence that any other conspirator said anything during that call that formed the basis for securities fraud. So we have at least two counts, I think, two of the misrepresentation counts, where the evidence that Skilling made the false statements is indisputable. And that being true, I think it follows that the jury must have found that he conspired to commit securities fraud. As to the remaining counts, I just want to briefly point out the difference between those counts and the securities fraud and conspiracy counts. There's no error in the false representation or insider trading counts. The Pinkerton theory did not apply to them. Those counts stood on their own, and therefore there's no error in those counts. And we would submit that it's therefore Skilling's burden to show an error before the government has to assume the burden of showing that the error was harmless. This is not a case where The jury had to choose between a valid and an invalid theory. It had simply had to follow the court's instructions and determine whether the error in other counts affected those counts. So it's
but
really
the same standard applies across the board to all counts. You're not saying that because they didn't somehow involve securities fraud or the conspiracy that we look at those differently from the other counts. The burden still
for the securities same. Fraud and the conspiracy count, I think the government bears the burden of showing that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because in both of those cases, the jury had the choice of choosing a valid or an invalid theory. I think the standard for the other counts, that is the false representation to auditor counts and the insider trading count, is different. Because in those cases, as I said, there is no error. So generally, it's up to the defendant to show error before the government has to show it's harmless. And there is no error in those counts. He's simply arguing that the error infected those counts. But again, I think that's his burden to show that the error infected them, not our burden to show that any error was harmless. And as we set forth in our brief at length, we think his arguments about the false representation counts and the insider trading counts are basically speculative, that there's really no evidence that the jury relied on the presence of honest services in the case to find the defendant guilty on those counts. The evidence on the insider trading count in particular is overwhelming. It's based on Skilling's own recorded statements, and it's, in our view, speculative to conclude that the jury would have relied on the presence of this invalid theory in other counts to convict him on counts on which there is no error at all.
Do you, I don't know if you would know, how long was the jury deliberate?
About 5 days, Your Honor.
On a five-month trial?
That's correct. The trial started at the end of January and went till, I believe, May 25th. Of 2006.
I don't know that it would affect just how, if the evidence is overwhelming, you get a quick verdict because the jury felt it was overwhelming, or if it takes a while, maybe it's not overwhelming. I was just looking at that angle of it, but
well, Your Honor,
that might not be I think relevant to what we're looking at. But
I think there are two points, Your Honor. First is 5 days is not a long time when you have a five-month trial. And secondly, and this is, you know, purely my own subjective view as someone who was there, this was a very careful jury, and I think they took their job carefully, and I think they parsed the evidence. But I think the length of deliberations is not long compared to the length of the trial and the amount of evidence that the jury had to go through. There were, I believe, more than 2,000 defense and government and defense exhibits, and somewhere around 50 witnesses. So. I don't think it's unusual for the jury to have deliberated 5 days. If the court has no further questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
Mr. Shelley, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. While both sides agree on the standard, I do think there's a violent disagreement on the application of the standard because, as the government points out, the standard on page 2, which we accept, no rational jury could have failed to find Skilling guilty of conspiring to commit securities fraud, the government then proceeds to do a sufficiency review and simply point out all the evidence that they believe existed in the record to support that count. We're not challenging for the purpose of this
remand and you've made that point effectively in your briefs and today.
Okay, Your Honor. And I just want to underscore that once you look at the entire record and you find for all these counts, evidence that would rationally lead to acquittal under the government's own standard, they must lose because the error cannot be found to be harmless in that circumstance. They brought up Sachs-Holly, and I did know that you were the trial judge in that case. And
still getting reversed.
Well, I won't talk about the Pettigrew case, though, okay? And Sachs-Holly doesn't apply here because the rule in Sachs-Holly in the line of cases is that in relying on the invalid theory of guilt, the court has to determine that the jury necessarily found all the elements that establish the valid theory of guilt. And that does not apply here because, as the judge instructed the jury, we're dealing with two different objects of the conspiracy. They have different elements, different scienter, different materiality requirements. And a jury easily could have found the breach of fiduciary duty under the honest services deposition without finding the elements of securities fraud. So Sachs-Hawley doesn't apply at all. And for every one of these transactions, there was always the ability for the jury to evaluate it and find breach of fiduciary duty and reject the securities fraud theory. LJM, they said that it was very risky and it was dangerous and it created Wall Street Journal risk and it was an imprudent, irresponsible, reckless thing to do. Earnings management, they attacked the process by which numbers were set. Even if the numbers were correct, they said the process was flawed. That's a breach of fiduciary duty. In the closing argument of the case by the prosecutor, he specifically cited to the Skilling and Lay not doing their jobs appropriately, not obeying their duties of honest services. One of the final things that he said, and contrary to the extreme focus on the indictment, both Judge Lake and the prosecutor told the jury that the indictment is not evidence and it doesn't even contain all the acts in question, and that if it did, it would be 1,000 pages, and that the government doesn't need to prove everything in the indictment, and the government can rest on things outside of the indictment. So the indictment was the charging document, but it wasn't the universe of issues that were being tried to the jury. On the Pinkerton, counsel concedes that there was an invalid theory, but he completely departs in the application. He says the test is whether the jury actually relied on the invalid theory or the valid theory. Well, we don't know because we have a general verdict. And so the test is just the same for that count, for those counts, as it was for count one, which is if there's evidence in the record by which a rational jury could have acquitted Skilling of securities fraud for his own direct acts, but nonetheless relied on the acts of others to convict him, then those counts must be reversed. And for every one of those counts, there were acts of others. The government says, well, they were not discussed in closing argument. Some were, including on slides that said that Skilling could be convicted for lies of Mark Koenig, for example. And they flashed these slides to the jury in closing argument. But the review is not limited to what can be said in a closing argument. We were under time limits in closing arguments, both sides. It's the presentation of the entire evidence. I mean, we had a lengthy 3-4 month trial where witnesses were constantly being examined about lies that they told under those counts.
And that goes to the credibility of a witness, doesn't it?
Excuse me?
That goes to the credibility of the witness. You're asking us to reweigh the credibility of the witnesses because they may have been cross-examined on lies.
No, not at all. What I'm pointing out is that the witnesses themselves said they lied in the securities fraud counts, that they committed securities fraud in respect of each of the counts on which Mr. Skilling was charged. So all the jury had to do was find that securities fraud was committed in furtherance or in foreseeable consequence of the conspiracy, which the jury instruction explicitly allowed the jury to do, and then rely on the acts of others to convict. And again, if there's any evidence in the record from which a rational jury could have decided the case that way, those convictions must be reversed. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Petrucelli. Your case is under submission, and the court is adjourned.
Thank you.